Welcome back to the Breezy Breakfast Community Broadcast. We begin another broadcast year with two updates featuring Danny Williamson, Layla Studs, and Skylar Williams. Danny Williamson updates us on all things COVID, like masks, social distancing, vaccines, school preparedness, and risk levels. These issues and many more will challenge our collective will to live during the dark days of winter. Layla Studs and Skylar Williams update us on local indigenous issues, water on reserve, and the land back movement.
Good morning. We're back from our August hiatus this Thursday, September the 8th. Just a bit of housekeeping. Because I am surrounded by political animals on the Breezy team, and because the Election Act forbids any candidates who are on-air personalities to be on the air during the electioneering process, we will not hear the erudite musings of Phil, Morgan, or Kevin until our October 27th episode. And just to clarify further, any candidate that were to come onto this show would not be able to say anything as well. Okay, so today we'll be getting up to speed on COVID, land back lane, and water issues on reserves. As we gather here in Guelph, let us remember that to the Mohawk Nation, we are gathered in Tadina Done, which means the place where they built. We are within the jurisdiction of the Two Row Wampum and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant. These are nation with nation agreements, and they serve as reminders that all the people on this land are still accountable for the promises made by their ancestors. In 1784, following the American Revolution, Sir Frederick Haldimand, who was the Governor-in-Chief of Canada, granted to the Six Nations of the Iroquois a tract of land extending for 6 miles on both sides of the Grand River from its source to Lake Erie. This grant was made in recognition of their services as allies of the British Crown during the war, and to compensate them for the loss of their former lands in northern New York State. Over time, this treaty has been broken, and large areas of this tract, including portion of the present counties of Haldimand, Brant, Waterloo, and Wellington, were sold to white settlers. Today, the Six Nations of the Grand River lands comprise of less than 5% of the 385,000 hectares of land that was originally granted. 5%. I mentioned the Dish with One Spoon Covenant because I believe in a world where people live in relation with this land such that we take only what we need from the dish, leave plenty enough for others, and keep the dish clean. I mentioned the Haldimand Treaty because we will be hearing an update on the situation in Caledonia. This treaty is one of many that has been broken in an egregious manner. And to make lasting changes for the future, we need to know the history that brings us here today. Now, today, our first guest is Danny Williamson from the Wellington Dufferin Guelph Public Health. So Danny, will you please get us updated on COVID?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me back, folks. I think last I was here, I think, Tanya, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to say it was around this time last year, kind of in the fall, and we were in a different place than we were then. We had just really hit our stride with vaccines. We hadn't seen sort of this Omicron variant yet. And now here we find ourselves in 2022. And so we are, I think it's important to have that realization that we're in a different place. We have very good vaccine coverage. And also as a province, we've sort of started to edge forward into something more normal. Does that mean A, we're back to normal, or B, that COVID is gone? It means neither of those things. So one of the things, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to hear me talk more than once this fall, this is what we're going to talk about, is kind of what does normal look like? And what do you, as a person who wants to keep yourself safe, as who wants to balance the idea of keeping yourself safe with getting back to some of those things that are important to you, right? Because public health is always about that balance, is how do we keep people as safe as possible as we realize that people need to go to work, they need to go to school, we need to have social connections. All those things are important. And so public health is always a balancing act of those factors. So as we find ourselves here in the year 2022, I'm looking at today's most recent kind of updates as of yesterday. So what I can tell you is right now our cases, especially those in hospital, have remained relatively stable over the last number of weeks, and let's say over the summer. Our confirmed cases, our case rate per 100,000 has been trending down. It's still higher than we'd like to see, but it's trending down. Same with test positivity. So how many of those tests come back positive as we test people for COVID? We have seen right now, we've got 209 active cases here in the region. Now, I should say all that is tough to compare with last year because our testing regimen in the province changed late last fall. So we are at sort of a stable position right now as we send ourselves into the fall. But here's what we do know. COVID is a respiratory illness. And what that means is, like the flu, as we go into the fall, as we get into colder weather, as we go back to school, as we go back to university, as lots of us come back to work from the summer, as we spend more time indoors, as we all like dread the coming cold months that are in the offing, those interactions are how respiratory viruses move around, right? We get indoors, we get closer together, and more of us are there. So all of those together are to say, as we move into this phase, right, like the province has sort of started us in a direction towards normalization. But here's what I want everybody, if you take nothing away from today, is that we still have COVID circulating. We know we're going to have a flu season this year. So one of the things about the pandemic is we saw a lot less flu. But what we're going to see, we think, in the fall is we're going to see a rise in cases of COVID. We're going to see a rise in flu cases. So that's the kind of context we're going to find ourselves in, is we know these things are circulating. We know that we're going to have a fall respiratory season, right? And so what does that mean? You know, we've moved away from this idea of sort of provincial sort of top-down mandates and sort of direction. And however you feel about it, we've sort of moved into, we're making individual calculations here. And this is what I want people to think about. And I'll use myself as an example, and hopefully that's helpful. So my wife, Erin, and I, we have two kids. One is 5, one is 1. We wear our masks a lot, right? My little one wears her mask to school. My wife and I wear our mask to work. We are boosted. So both of our kids have now had 2 shots. My wife and I have just gotten our second boosters. So that's the context that you need to think about here, is what is your own personal risk to yourself and those around you? And then how can you layer in those protections? So the most important thing you can do, and I'll talk about the sort of vaccine picture of the fall, but the most important thing you can do is be as up to date as you can, right? It is as you hit that sort of 84 days is kind of what they say is the magic number. But as you hit that number, it's time to start thinking about a booster again, because we know those boosters, their effectiveness is kind of between 4 and 6 months, and then they start to tail off. So it's really important to keep yourself up to date. Second, stay home when you're sick. If you have the luxury of sick days, if you have the ability to stay home, and you know, we can sort of unpack sick days and paid sick days, like that complicates the issue, let's say. But if you have the ability, stay home if you're sick, right? It's something I think, you know, as, certainly from public health perspective, that we'll talk about in the coming years, is we need to do a better job of normalizing being at home when you're sick. And the third thing is, understand when a mask is going to help you, right? So I talked about my family's own profile. You know, we are on the assertive end of masking because we have a little one who's just not even in the 2 weeks of her second dose. that's sort of a, just our perspective on it. But if you're going to spend significant time indoors, if you're going to be around people, especially if you don't know their vaccine status, if you're going to be in any kind of crowd, it's a really good practice for us to start normalizing mask use, right? A good, well-fitted, especially like an N95 mask, a really good, well-fitted mask is going to really add a layer of protection there for you. So those are the pieces, those three pieces that we've been talking about for, you know, almost the entire pandemic are still good tools to keep you safe. And so, you know, as we think about the fall and as we're sort of all making these kind of individual risk calculations, it's really important to think about what you and those around you and your neighbors, right? And so let me talk at the individual level, then I'll talk at the maybe the civic level, given our audience here and my intention to talk at the civic level. But understand your risk, right? You know, lots of people are going to say, well, I'm young, relatively young, and I'm healthy and I'm boosted, so I'm probably going to be fine, which the numbers say is quite likely, right? If you're young and healthy and you're boosted, you're going to be in pretty good shape. But we know many of us, you know, I talked about my young children. Many of us have immunocompromised people in our life. Many of us have elderly parents, granddads, neighbors. We have a bit of a chance to extend that protection to other people, right? So it, like many of us, we're starting to see more people, right? We're starting to kind of come out of our family shell a little bit. And we're trying to be really conscious that we can impact the health of the others around us with our choices. And then, so I think those are two good pieces as you think about this risk, this kind of risk profile as you come out of the pandemic is what can I do to protect myself? But also what are some things, and really folks, all these are fairly low threshold, ask especially max vaccinations and masks. All COVID vaccinations are free. You can still get them pretty much anywhere. And so how can we as a community still extend that kind of shield of protection to protect other people? Because we know even though sort of COVID has sort of stabilized for now and, you know, we expect to see more in the fall, we've put a ton of pressure on our healthcare system in the last 3 years. And, you know, it had its challenges before the pandemic, but we have definitely put it on our nurses and our ER rooms and our doctors and our walk-in clinics. We've put a lot of pressure on that system. And, you know, I don't need to go into all the pieces in the news because everybody can go and see those for ourselves, but this is a great time to not put additional strain on the healthcare system. And so if we can blunt the flu season, if we can limit that COVID wave, if we see one in the fall, those are good, right? It's good to not get COVID no matter how well protected you are. It's good to not give it to other people, and it's good to reduce the system impacts of COVID. So those are the pieces that are really, that's how it is useful kind of on a personal level, I think, to think about COVID into the fall. And I wanted to, Tanya had a couple of questions about vaccines that I definitely want to get to as well. So let me talk to you about kind of the rainbow of vaccines this fall. So right now, if you're an adult in Ontario, you're eligible for a fourth dose if you're above 18. For some of us who are immunocompromised, you're going to be eligible for a fifth dose because that's just how the series of vaccinations work. If you're a kid, three doses over five, two doses under five. And then a lot of you will have heard of the bivalent vaccine, the Omicron plus vaccine, the Omicron vaccine. These are all the same thing, folks. And what a bivalent, so bivalent two, what the bivalent vaccine is, it's a two-part vaccine that contains the original COVID strain, which is what all the vaccines have contained up until this point. And it also contains an Omicron variant. So this current version contains the BA1. And so that those two pieces come together in a single shot. And it looks like they're going to really help blunt that that effectiveness of Omicron. Because, you know, we've certainly seen, you know, even though the original vaccines provide good good protection against those most severe outcomes, and we really do see that still with hospitalizations and with death, it's still the best indicator of you doing well out of that is being vaccinated. We there is some, and again, I don't work on the science side of public health, but there is some data out there that suggests that being well vaccinated is also provides some protection against long COVID. So there's lots of great reasons, even if you only have access to the kind of the OG vaccines, to still get those. But this bivalent, it does look like it's going to kind of bump up that fight against Omicron somewhat. What I know is that, always what kind of happens with these vaccine approvals is it comes from the federal level. So you'll have heard the acronym NACI. So that's the National Advisory Council on Immunization. And they are the ones who provide the kind of Canada-wide recommendations on vaccinations and approving vaccines. Then it comes to the provincial level, the province decides which health units get what volume in what order, who is eligible at what time. And then it comes to your local health unit, your healthcare facilities, your pharmacies to kind of execute that vaccine plan. So the federal part has happened. We're expecting the provincial approvals as early as today, and then we're gonna start rolling. What I want people to understand about that is it's going to look like many of the early vaccine additions. So we're not going to get all the vaccine we need in our first shipment. We're going to get several thousand doses for each of the first couple of weeks, and then we're really going to open the floodgate. So we're going to do what we've done at every stage of the vaccine program, which is make sure our most vulnerable folks are taken care of first. So you can go and look at who we started with in every kind of wave of the vaccination program, and that, you know, it's going to be immunocompromised, it's going to be seniors, it's going to be members of the various First Nations, Inuit and Métis communities. And then as we expand supply, then we're all going to get access to it. So that is boosters. That's the bivalent and Omicron booster. And the other piece that we're going to see this fall is the flu shot, right? If you haven't had your flu shot in the last couple of years, it's a great thing to get back to. In a lot of the public health clinics you're going to see this fall, you're going to have the chance to get both because they can be administered together. But we know this is going to be a complicated respiratory season this fall, right? We know we saw like almost no flu cases in the last couple of years, but we know they're coming back, and we know COVID is going to take a rise. So get both those shots. If you, and I talked about sort of individual risk profile a little bit a minute ago, if you for some reason need to get vaccinated right away, if it's been a while and you're with someone who's immunocompromised, get the vaccine that's available to you. If you have a bit of flexibility over the next couple of weeks, you know, certainly kind of into the end of September and by Thanksgiving, most of us are going to have access to that Omicron booster. So whether it's the one, if you need it right now, good to get it right now. Those sort of original vintage vaccines still work really well. If you can wait a little bit, that Omicron one is coming. But the key is, get one of them, stay as up to date as you can. Like I said, it's kind of 4 to 6 months is that window of protection, but it really does make a huge difference. It really does. Even, you know, you've heard things like vaccine escape, you've heard about sort of waning immunity. What we can tell you is they still work and they still protect you. And it's still the best predictor of you not ending up in hospital, you not passing away from COVID. Like I said, it has some impact on long COVID. It really is the like that bottom layer of protection. If you start with being up to date on your vaccines, that is a really strong foundation for your protection this fall. So I don't want to go on too long because I know there's lots of stuff to talk about today. So Tanya, why don't I give it back to you and you can throw some of those questions at me.
Okay, so my first question is with regard to the new vaccine. Mm-hmm. I am glad that you have clarified that there is only one new vaccine, and it is the original plus the BA1 yep. variant. Because for some reason, I thought that there was an even newer one that included the BA2 variant.
Yeah, so I guess the way to think about it, Tanya, is this, is that there are, you know, I think at one point there was like 70 vaccines in trial. kind of worldwide. And so this is a thing you're going to see, I think, right? Over the next year or two, you're going to see these updates. And it's going to be a little bit like the flu shot, right? So every year, folks, if you don't know, during flu season, we get a bit of a different formulation for the flu shot. And that's them looking at what flu they believe is going to be circulating and formulating accordingly. So the nice thing about these mRNA vaccines is that you're going to see it creates some flexibility in terms of the makeup of the vaccine. So they're able to kind of take that platform and layer in what's circulating. So, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, we're working on BA1. So, I mean, that's a couple of BAs ago, folks. Now we're on to BA4 and 5, but it does give them some of that flexibility to continue to update these vaccines. And so you'll continue to see that over the next year or two. You know, if COVID becomes an annual thing as a booster, you know, we don't have the answers to all those questions, but you're going to see those vaccines get updated over time. And that's pretty natural in terms of some of these viruses that change kind of on a more annual basis or on a more rapid basis, is you're going to see formulations of the vaccines be different depending on what's out there in the wild.
Okay, thank you. That answers another question that I had about, effectiveness of the Omicron vaccine after one has actually contracted Omicron. So it'll still be something that you would want to get.
Yeah, folks, like if you glazed out for like a good portion of it, like the people that the people upstairs in my house do, that's okay. But the most important thing to take away is get vaccinated, right? Get, like, when you hit that eligibility date for a booster, go and get it, please. It's so important, and it's such an important starting layer of protection.
I read that there was a change in Ontario in isolation protocol. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us a bit about that and why that has been instituted?
Sure. So I won't necessarily talk about the why, because that's a sort of provincial level decision. Essentially, what's happened is we've changed from the 5 days to cessation of symptoms, right? And so it's really become more of a, you know, here is a number and follow the number, to a symptoms-based approach. Now, you know, I think the way to sort of think about that is, how can I, as a person who may or may not have symptoms, who may not have tested positive, how can I protect those around me? So I talked about that sort of civic level. I talked about that civic level piece. But that really is it. So when you are self-isolating, how do you protect those around you? So it is still important to follow that process, right? It is still important to make sure that you get tested, even if that's a home test. It is still important to wear a mask, especially. And it is still important to follow the guidelines. So it is really important to make sure that you're through your symptoms. Now, just because your symptoms have disappeared, it doesn't mean that you may not still have the potential to shed COVID. So one of the things we strongly encourage is, if you're coming back, you know, if those symptoms are gone, if you've tested negative, we'd strongly encourage you to wear a mask for 4 or 5, you know, days afterwards, because that's going to be an added layer of protection for those around you. So it is, I think, provincially, we've sort of moved into a more endemic way of thinking of COVID, right? We've sort of started to incorporate it into our thinking about our annual respiratory virus season. And so there is a sense that we move away from this self-isolation kind of mandated number to thinking about those symptoms. But like I say, being vaccinated helps control those symptoms. It helps reduce how much COVID you can spread. And wearing that mask, you know, even if you've come out of that isolation period, you're feeling great, you've tested negative, it doesn't hurt to wear that mask for a few days as you're coming off self-isolation to make sure that you're not kind of a vector for spread.
Absolutely. And I remember before the guidelines were changed, we did have to wear a mask 4 or 5 days after we tested negative. I know that because I got COVID. So that was the rule.
I think the way to think about this, folks, is you have a set of things that the province requires you to do, right? And I have tried to think about this, and I, you know, everybody's situation is different, but I would think about those as the minimum standard, right? The minimum standard is to stay home until your symptoms have been gone for 24 hours or 48 if you've had sort of vomiting or diarrhea, right? So those are sort of your minimum standards. What other layers can you, right? Like masks are not a hardship, right? Distancing is not a hardship. Being thoughtful about where you go is not a hardship. So those pieces are, what layers can you, like if you know you've been exposed or you know you've been positive, what layers of protection can you put on yourself for at a civic level to protect those around you?
Okay. And now that gets me to, you mentioned large crowds, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I have a question. Mm-hmm. Are we becoming a little bit too lax? Are we safe outdoors when we aren't 6 feet apart? So should we be wearing masks outdoors if we can't be 6 feet apart?
So are we becoming too lax is kind of an it depends question. So it depends what you're doing with your daytime, right? So like, I mean, I sort of talked about my own situation. We're pretty stringent around here, but different people have different risk profile. So you're always better outdoors, right? Just the nature of air circulation and COVID being trapped in a closed room with a bunch of us. So you're always safer outdoors. You're always a bit safer if you can kind of provide a little distance. But it depends. It's going to have to come down to that understanding of your own risk. So if you're a person who's going to be at more risk, so I'm taking my little one to her first baseball game next week. We're going to sort of play it by ear. So if we end up in a crowded section, we're going to put our masks on. It's an afternoon game. So if it's a little bit lightly attended, we'll probably take them off. But that's the piece that you need to think about is, what is your risk profile? What do you know about the people you're with? And can I layer on those protections that make me both comfortable and safe, depending on who I am and who's around me? So I hate giving it depends as an answer, but it does depend, right? So each of these things is a piece of the protection, right? So it's not that you're safe or not outdoors. It's what are the layers when you're outdoors to make yourself a bit safer, right? Because you can't eliminate all risk, but you can do some of these things that make you a little bit safer.
Absolutely. I didn't mean to make it like an either or question.
No, totally. And so, people, like, it is hard to not think about it in that either or, right? But it is, I think, you know, you asked me the question by email, what can we expect in the fall and winter? It's not, we're out of the either or business, and we're into the, what are the things that make sense and we can add as layers of protection? Like, I think that's really the thing to think about in the fall and the winter is, the universe willing, we have a nice, long, mild fall and we can kind of be outside for quite a bit of it. I'm a big baby and I don't love the cold, so I tend to be a bit of an indoor creature in the winter. But if I want to go to something, my wife and I have Nana coming to town in a couple of weeks, so we're going to go to our first movie since the pandemic started. We're going to wear a mask. Right. So it's really, how can we get those layers? Right. And I've talked about a bunch of different pieces here. And how can you layer those things on to make yourself a bit safer? That's going to be the piece, right? We all get vaccinated. That's a layer. We wear masks when it's smart. That's a layer. We stay home when we're sick. That's a layer. You know, we improve ventilation where we can. That's a layer. We make space where we can. That's a layer. And so all those layers, as you add them together, those are how we kind of improve those outcomes.
Yes, and you mentioned ventilation, and I'm not sure if you're the person to ask about this, but I think it's on a lot of people's minds. What are schools doing to prepare for the fall and winter? Because we've known for over 2 years that one of the biggest things that we can do indoors is to improve ventilation.
Sure. So let me talk about that. So that really falls under the Ministry of Ed. So let me talk about it as a dad who has a school down the street that he's going to go do drop off to very shortly. Schools have done a really good job about layering in sort of HEPA filters and ventilation protection. I know the province has done some investments in improving air quality. I know a lot of schools are working on sort of open windows while it's nice and getting outdoors when it's nice. But it is one of the places we have to keep thinking about it. You know, I said sort of my daughter goes with a mask on, and that's been she's one of only a couple of kids in her class who's doing it, but it is, again, those sort of risk calculations, right? Is, you know, we can improve air quality, but, you know, you have a bunch of little bodies and their teacher in a room. So, you know, improving air quality makes a difference. Improved ventilation makes a difference, but it can't make 100% difference, right? And so that's the way, like we talked a little bit before about whether it's either or, you know, from my perspective, is sort of I take my public health hat off. I know schools are trying to do a lot. I know that there's been those investments. It can't make 100% difference, right? It can't eliminate the risk of COVID in school, right? Because I don't know every kid's vaccination status in my kid's class. I don't want to. But those layers of protection, we know that we can add on, right? We know that schools are trying to do a good job about ventilation. You know, I've already seen them outdoors. You know, we do the outdoor gathering at the beginning of the school day. We do all those pieces. But again, you know, you talk about where do we feel confident, right? Where do we know our protections exist? And it's adding those layers on. That's where those protections exist. So, you know, we went and got her double dosed before, you know, so that it was at least 14 days before school started. We still do masks. So it's those pieces, right?
Okay, absolutely. And I'm just going to ask one more question, which is probably more of a clarification.
Sure.
Are the masks, I see a lot of people wearing masks that are well fitted.
Yep.
However, they are made out of cloth.
Yeah.
Do those do anything?
So this is going to go back to the, you know, I've kind of circled around this thing a couple of times, but every layer is better, right? Every layer of protection you add is better. You know, so our cloth layers, they're better than nothing, but we would pretty strongly encourage people to wear a well-fitted kind of N95 mask. Really the answer is the best mask available to you, right? And so, I mean, we use N95s. If you go to our clinic, you'll see the blue surgical masks. It really is like, we know those N95 masks, are really sort of the standard we want people to aim for. But again, like there's a lot, you know, a lot of our access to, you know, the pandemic has been asymmetrical. I'm an East Coaster. So my mom is fond of the expression, we're all in the same storm, but we're in different boats, right? As opposed to this, we're all in the same boat. So it is wise to think about what our privilege affords us in terms of COVID protections, but, you know, get the best mask available to you and make sure it's well fitted. We would say get an N95 if you can, but something is better than nothing.
Okay, thank you for making that clarification. And I'd like to thank you for coming on
to
give us this update. We really appreciate it. I think the takeaway message is know your risk level and continue to do the things that mitigate risks.
Uh-huh. And get vaccinated, folks. Please, please.
Yes, no matter what the vaccine available to you is.
Get the one available to you. Get, if you can wait, get that Omicron plus booster and get your flu shot. Get both those this fall, folks, and that's your best start to kind of keeping yourself safe and well over the fall.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, folks. Take care.
Okay, so our next update is with regard to Indigenous land and water, and I have been told that Skylar is busy right now and will be joining us in a few minutes. So first I'd like to go to Layla Statt. She's Mohawk Six Nations of the Grand River, and her film Blood and Water is a self-narrated documentary detailing the legacy of the residential school system. Layla is also very knowledgeable about the issues of water on reserves. So Leila, I would like to give you the floor.
Sego. Skena go again, Leila stats young yats, anawada niwa gi daroden, ganyak gehaga, niwa go wenjoden, oswego nida wageno. So hello everyone, my name is Leila Stats. I am Mohawk Turtle Clan, like Tanya was saying, and I'm from the Six Nations of the Grand River. I'm a generational survivor of residential schools, the Mohawk Institute in Brantford. And, you know, I introduced myself to you in my language of Mohawk, Ganyak Kehaga, but that language, you know, that wasn't something that was given to me. That was something I had to reclaim. That was something I had to, you know, take back for myself. And I've been on this reclamation journey for the last few years of relearning who I am as a Mohawk woman and you know, undoing some of the traumas that I didn't even realize were there, that, you know, we're still facing. So the documentary, I created this documentary 2 years ago, just myself. I'd never done anything like it. I just knew that I had a story inside of me. And, you know, I put it together, I edited, I filmed it. And now I've been screening it with schools and organizations. We're screening it at the Celebration of Nations this weekend with Buffy and the Water Walker and all of these amazing events. So it's been really powerful to see this little project that I worked on kind of just for a healing tool for myself that has connected with so many people. And one of the fundamental lessons in the film is that even though, you know, even it was my grandfather, actually, my grandfather, he was very ashamed of his native blood. He told us to hide it. He told us, we, you know, don't let people know that you're native. You won't get the job. You won't get as many opportunities. He had this, what we call the code of shame, that had been passed down because of these residential schools. But even though he didn't teach me my language or ceremonies, he always taught me about this connection to water. He dug these ponds on our land and built these houses and had these ecosystems, and we would walk the land every day. And so even though they, you know, they tried to beat the Indian out of him, you know, that essential connection that we have to the water and the land, they couldn't take that away. And he passed that down to me. And it's what sparked this knowing, this connection, this relationship that I have with water. So now I'm working on my next documentary, and it's all about the boil water advisories in First Nations communities. I've traveled to 7 different communities, both in Canada and the United States. So I was at the Navajo, I was out in California, I was with the Hopi, I was in Wet'suwet'en, Grassy Narrows, Nishkaniga, all of these places to share the story of, you know, what these communities are facing with trying to you know, fight for their right for clean water. And, you know, the one thing that I've seen in all of these places is these underlying parallels of connected trauma. You know, the issue of residential schools came up often, the issue of alcoholism, drug abuse, suicide. You know, I spoke with a young girl who, you know, just it just broke my heart that she had, you know, tried to commit suicide, and she was saying that they feel like they don't exist. And Nishkaniga has been under a boil water advisory for 27 years. So, you know, they feel like there is no hope. No one is listening. No one is paying attention. So one of the things that I feel is really important is for us to understand, you know, these water issues. The constant, you know, place that we're in with this climate emergency, it is not just an Indigenous issue. Indigenous communities are feeling this first because of, you know, because of the systematic, I guess, protocols that have been put in place on reserves where there is no infrastructure. You know, it's often said that Natives weren't expected to last. You know, the reserves weren't meant as a long-term sort of option. So they didn't have infrastructure for water and these things that we take for granted. But we're really, you know, I say this all the time, you know, we're talking about COVID And, you know, remember at the beginning of COVID, when we ran out of toilet paper, and how frightening that actually was, you know, and people were panicked and people were, you know, worried. And that's toilet paper. So when it becomes water, and we're lining up for rations, in Grassy Narrows, they get 1.5 liters of water a day per person. That is their ration. And, you know, it gets flown in, it gets delivered to their house. But, you know, that feeling of lack, that there's not enough of it for all of us, that is very real. And I think at all of us as citizens, we need to take more responsibility for the protection of the water. It should not just be Indigenous land defenders and water protectors that are there, because, you know, I think about it all the time, like, how much water did we use today? How about this morning when you did the dishes, or you turned on the laundry before you left, or, you know, you had a shower and you didn't even think about it? You know, that's kind of become our normal programming of this resource of water. Whereas when we look at a deeper connection, that, you know, we look back at the Ongwahome, the original people, we look back at the teachings of this relationship with water. Water is alive. Water is, you know, it's an entity. You know, everything changed for me when I started to see water as almost as a person. You know, as part of my family. And we have a saying, all of our relations. And that means all of it, the trees, the animals, the plants, the water, we are all in a family and we are all relatives. So then when I started to see this destruction, I was in Grassy Narrows where they have mercury poisoning and a paper mill making paper up the river, dumped mercury into their waters. And now their community is riddled with mercury poisoning. And, you know, it's like, it was a scary, eye-opening experience, because I didn't understand the issues of mercury poisoning and what happens when someone gets mercury poisoning from, you know, from eating contaminated fish and eating contaminated food. So what happens is especially when a mother is pregnant, the child in the womb actually gets double the concentration of mercury. So instead of it going away by generation, it's actually amplifying, it's actually getting worse. And these youngsters are starting to feel tremors in their hands. They're starting to lose memory. And they're very, you know, it's not hard to see why depression and mental health is such an issue. Because, you know, the one young lady said to me, she felt like she had like a timer on her life, and it was ticking down, and it's ticking down so fast. You know, it's just so, for us to see that and to see the water in its, you know, that the destruction we're causing for a paper mill, for white paper, you know, and not even thinking about that, not even understanding that, it's like, this is our family. The water is our family. So when I went to Wet'suwet'en, I was in Wet'suwet'en recently, and November actually was arrested in Wet'suwet'en for defending their river and their lands. And I saw this river, the Wendziqua on the west coast in BC, and it is pristine. It is glacier fed. I drank right from it. I cupped my hands and put it to my mouth, and it tingled on my tongue. It felt, I could feel that it was alive. I could feel that energy. And it was as if, you know, thinking about my river here, the Grand River, you know, I wouldn't even let my kids swim in it. You know, I wouldn't trust anything from it to eat. And, you know, that's just the reality of most of our lives, that most of us will never drink directly from a river. Most of us will never drink from, you know, a body of water, because of the destruction that we've already created. So here we have this beautiful river that they want to put a pipeline under. And it's like, are we not thinking that this, you know, we have to think ahead, think forward, look at what the damage that we've done. So, you know, when it came to that point of, you know, deciding what to do, you know, whose laws am I living by? Whose laws are the true laws that are going to preserve this land and the future for our generations? you know, I saw that river, I saw that water as my brother, and my brother being, you know, under siege, my brother being attacked, and I had no choice but to stand up. But it also brings, you know, as Skylar will be here soon, he just texted me that he's going to be jumping on, but it also brings that, that idea to the forefront of the laws that we live in, and the policies, and the you know, the system that is in place right now. And it's interesting, I actually, you know, I got asked, I was doing a speech at Queen's Park, and they said, well, can you do the land acknowledgement? And I said, okay, I'll do the land acknowledgement, but it's going to be a little different. And so it's after these years, about 3 years now of doing land acknowledgements with politicians and organizations and schools, and you know, it's, it becomes to the point where now we have to demand more. Now that we've acknowledged whose territory this is, who the original, you know, caretakers and stewards of this land are, now we have to demand action. So, you know, and that, that was one challenge that I put out for a lot of the unions and the organizations, was to rewrite your land acknowledgements and to include an actionable statement where we, as citizens of this country, as Canadians, we want a new Canada. We want a new relationship. We want a new honoring and respect. And that does come from the laws that are in place. Right now, I am being criminalized in court for defending this river that, you know, these tribes depend on, that these tribes have protected since time immemorial. And that, to me, is, a, you know, that's a broken system. That's a system that needs to be looked at. So, you know, asking our leaders to, you know, to stand behind the land acknowledgement, acknowledge and land action as well. What are we doing to honor the treaties? What are we doing to implement UNDRIP? What are we doing to, you know, to preserve the water? Many of us, you know, you think about it right now, how many of us really know where the water came from that comes out of our tap? How many of us really know where it goes when it goes down the drain? What happens to it? We have completely, we've completely dissociated from that resource because it's just always been there. Someone else will take care of it. Someone else will protect it. You know, our politicians, our leaders, you know, Trudeau, he's going to protect the water. Of course he is, because water is life. Everything needs water for life. So I'm sure that, you know, the guys at the top are making sure it's protected, right? And we've kind of checked out and given away our responsibility to that. Whereas I challenge people to take it back. I challenge people to continue to question and, you know, ask yourself, you know, when you see, you actually every factory, every industrial sort of building, you see they're always along the water. And I was very surprised that in on Environment Canada's website, you can actually find out what kind of things are being dumped in the water. But it's very small, very hard to find. No one knows about it. No one's reading it, but they have to report on the things that they're dumping. And so, you know, we went to that paper mill and we went back there, and they on their online is saying there's arsenic going in the water, you know, and I'm like, how is this okay? How can we not demand more? As Canadians, we have this most beautiful landscape, the most beautiful water, fresh water supply in the world, and we're taking it for granted. We're destroying it for a dollar. We're, you know, these corporations, these entities are coming in and, you know, selling us back our water because they know the value. My papa always said, you know, no matter what happens, make sure that you find a way to protect the water, and whoever in the end has the water, going to be the ones that survive. Water will be like gold. Water is now on the stock markets. You know, like we have seen a foreshadow of what everyday life could be like by looking into these Indigenous communities. So I'm really hoping that the new documentary, it's coming out next year, is going to open some eyes, is going to really wake people up to not only the fight, the struggle that's going on within Indigenous communities, but how this transcends into the bigger picture of, you know, all of us, and all of us coming together to take this stand for the water. So yeah, I'm really excited that, you know, that we're getting this opportunity to share these stories and people are listening. I think that that's the one thing that really keeps me optimistic, because it can feel like a huge battle. It can feel like a really big mountain to climb, and the odds, the laws, the policies are all stacked against us. So to hear, you know, people that are taking this information, they're taking this knowledge to speak to, you know, an entire board of school teachers and share the documentary and get into their classrooms and work with the youth and see that people are actually listening. People are paying attention. People are waking up. And I feel that shift. And it gives me this vision that this change will come. The only way change will come, the only way that we're going to have any chance of surviving this climate emergency is from the people, because I have very little faith in the people at the top. You know, I have very little faith in our leadership and our policies, but I have so much faith in Canadians. I have so much faith in the people and the hearts of us, that when we truly know, when we know the truth, you can't unknow it. And when you see it, you can't unsee it. So now that people have seen, now that people know, I feel the shift is happening. So that, you know, I like to, you know, share a little bit of optimism and a little bit of hope, and just kind of put it back to you, because you will be the one that, you know, our voices matter. And it, you, when people start seeing that, hey, it's not just Indigenous people that are talking about pipelines and Wet'suwet'en and water and land. It's like my neighbor Sheila. It's Nick over at the running club. It's my kid's teacher. You know, it's all of us coming together for this unified voice and this awakening, this awareness. So that's my hope for you.
I want to thank you very much for talking to us about the importance of water, especially to consider water as an entity, like a member of the family. Thank you for you're in the process of making a documentary about water on reserves. And we would love to ask you if you could do a screening in Guelph. So I think we'll get in touch with you about that.
For sure. I've actually done a couple of screenings in Guelph of my current documentary, Blood and Water. And I find that it's kind of a good preview to the connection that we have with water and where it comes from and some of the traumas that have tried to sever us from that connection, but it still remains. And it's really powerful that way. But I would love to do, I've been doing them virtually and now in person as well, since we are in person again. So I'm looking forward to being in St. Catharines tonight to host that sort of deeper discussion. But yeah, I mean, that was the one thing. I've been doing a lot of work with youthsters and youth, and they'll come up to me and they'll say, you know, Miss Stats, like I said hi to the river yesterday. I drove past and I said hi, and you know, I went to my tree and I talked to my tree. And you know, it's just like this, we all kind of need to reprogram our kindergarten brain to be able to see the world around us and our relationship with it. It's a constantly evolving and changing relationship, just like any relationship you have with your friends, your family, your partner. You know, you have to constantly be looking at it and saying, okay, what can I do to make this better? What do I get from this entity? What do I give to this entity, and how can I improve? And you're constantly looking at those ways that you can improve. So the first thing is to start it. So I challenge you to go out and, you know, sit with the water, talk to the water. It might feel weird because we're grown-ups and we've been programmed to think that that's weird, but I'm telling you, there's a healing medicine that comes in the water. I've always felt that it knows me, you know, and it sees me, and it's a place where I can just let everything out. And that's sacred to me. So I really feel like once we all have that relationship woken up inside of us, you know, we have to protect it, because it's you know, it's our family, it's our life, it's all connected. So, you know, we'll take a stronger stand.
Absolutely. Thank you for opening our eyes, and especially the kids, because that's where the change is going to happen the easiest. I see that Skylar is here. Welcome, Skylar. We would love to hear your update. So I hand the floor to you.
Hi, everybody. And, you know, I always, and, you know, Layla, my partner in crime here, is always a hard act to follow, you know, and so I will do my best. So I'm Skylar Williams. I've been the spokesperson at 1492 Landback Lane these last couple of years. And over these last couple of years, it has been some of the, you know, we've seen, you know, hundreds of OPP out to enforce this injunction that was, you know, set in place over 2 years ago now. And here we are yet again, headed back to court. So for folks that don't know, there was an injunction at 1492 Landback Lane that was tried to be enforced on August 5th and then again on October 22nd. Six Nations folks and all of our allies, and I mean hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, showed up to make sure that the OPP knew loud and clear that this is going to be Haudenosaunee land. And in one of those instances, some roads got dug up, a highway, a railway, all got dug up in order to protect the land and also to keep our people safe. That was right after people had gotten shot at and rubber bullets, people that hit with rubber bullets, tasered and dragged off our lands. And after that, our people showed up, our allies showed up, everybody and anybody showed up, whether that was to bear witness or to put their bodies in front of whatever machine was rolling onto our lands. And so we were very, very grateful for that. We then hired some lawyers and appealed the injunction that was set in place by the Superior Court in Cayuga. We won at the Ontario Court of Appeal, and we thought that was the win, and we were done with all the court stuff and the injunctions and all the rest of it, and until a few months ago, when the developer applied to the same court that gave them the injunction in the first place, that had all of those hundreds of cops come onto our territory. So that developer is back to court again, reapplying for that same injunction at the same court that granted their injunction, but not only granted them the injunction, but also barred us from participating. And so myself, I was the one named party. And so I participated, I was self-represented, and we were barred, I was barred and muted. It was all on Zoom at the time. Now it's going to be in person. So September 12th and 13th, that's Monday and Tuesday of next week, we're going to be in the Superior Court in Cayuga, 9 o'clock in the morning. There's a rally planned out front. Actually, Layla's doing some of the planning around the rally out front. Might be able to give us some insight into what's happening there, but I know a lot of folks are planning on attending. Myself, I don't got much of a choice in the matter. I'm going to be in the court. But yeah, there is supposed to be a rally outside, and it's going to be quite the thing, because I mean, like, these injunctions have been used in the past and in the present as just a tool for these massive companies to be able to, you know, strong arm the police into enforcing them. And so, like, the police would be able to, you know, get us on like trespassing or something like that. But with these, it gives them an extra tool to be able to really force the issue. And so we've had about 50 people arrested for their involvement in Landback Lane, and all but I think five of us are still going to court, but 45 of them have all gotten their charges thrown out. And so even the charges that they stick on people are not meant as to get a conviction. They're just meant to be able to put down that resistance. And so when we see these big companies with, you know, bottomless pockets when it comes to being able to throw money at these things, we see, like, whether you're talking about Wet'suwet'en, whether you're talking about Kitigan-Zibi with their moose moratorium, or Mi'kmaq fishers, or like the Sequetmec folks out in the Tiny House Warriors, like every one of those spaces of resistance, you know, are like the one common thread between all of them, besides it being Indigenous, is these injunctions. And so it really is these you know, the tool of dispossession of that, you know, 500-year-old song and dance of, you know, white people coming onto our lands and dispossessing us, and kind of like, for a lot of us, that connection for us, you know, I think Layla talked about that connection to water, like that connection for us to the land and to each other and the water, like those are things that are intrinsic to us, that are part of who we are as Haudenosaunee people. And you know, the blood, sweat, and tears that went into us being able to have that 6 miles on each side of that Grand River, our people fought and died so that, you know, our children and us could have this place to thrive on. But over the last, you know, 100 years, we've seen development encroach and continue to encroach on our traditional lands. And so now we are hemmed in all the way around our reserve to a point where, you know, we can't grow. You know, there's one thing that's, you know, common amongst any big city, I don't care whether it's a big city or a small town, like they've all grown and grown and grown exponentially over the last, you know, 100, 200 years. The only places that have gotten smaller in those last 200 years are reserves. And we continue to see our borders shrink around us at a point now where, you know, like our communities are being fractured by that land's dispossession. You know, it forces our members of our nations into the cities around us. And this is where we see, you know, alcoholism, drug abuse, all of those kind of, you know, Indian stereotypes that, you know, we all work so very hard to put down, but these are the things that perpetuate that system of violence and that system of separating us from our people. And so when we have these opportunities to come together, like this is an opportunity that we have to really be able to push in the right direction to make sure that these lands stay ours.
Right. It sounds like, if you don't mind, I was going to ask you to expand upon why it is so important to have the land back, you know, for the children and for others who have been separated, torn away from their ancestors. And to bring people back home, they need somewhere to go to come back home to.
Absolutely. And I think that's exactly what we're working towards. And the more that people are willing to, you know, get behind that movement and be able to push in the right direction and do it in a good way, in a way that's, you know, peaceful. And, you know, like, that's the thing, is the only time that we've ever seen any kind of weapons come to land back, and it's been at the hands of the OPP. And, you know, a badge on your chest goes a long way to stir up that more violence.
I would like to ask, got some chat stuff here. I'd like to ask about the financial support with regards to the charges and fighting in the courts. What kind of financial support do you receive?
Yeah, no, we've had a ton of support in terms of that. We had a GoFundMe going last year. I know we're going to be needing more of that support again in the very near future, but right now we're just like, regardless of what happens in this courtroom, people need to understand that doesn't sever that connection for us to these lands. And so that means that we are going to be there regardless of what any piece of paper from any court in any way anywhere
has to say to us, because you know what, that land for us and the birthright of our children that and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, these lands is their birthright. And you know, far be it for me to shrug my shoulders at what belongs to our kids and our grandkids.
Okay, so I also, it is my understanding that you also spent some time out west at Wet'suwet'en. Would you like to talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, Layla was also there with me on that one, and yeah, it was. This is what the violence, the level of intimidation, of the threat of violence that you know, the state is willing to enforce on Indigenous people that stand up for their lands. And you know, like you're talking about, you know, RCMP dropping out of helicopters and attack dogs and AR-15s, and you know, like it was probably the most beautiful trip I've ever had in my life, to be able to be up in the mountains and put my hands in that water and take a drink. And yeah, and I don't think I can put it any, you know, like when you know, that water touches your lips, it's like electricity, you know, that ability to put your hand, like we live on the Grand River, you know, we're more likely to catch a shopping cart from No Frills or a 1978 BMX bike than a salmon out of our river. And so when you get to see these, you know, take a drink from that water and see these massive fish, salmon swimming in that river, like that's something that, you know, it drives it home just how important water is in our communities, just how important it is that we make these stands for our waters. And but also it is a very glaring look at what the state is willing to do to protect the financial interests of these huge companies that are running pipelines, are doing these developments, and you know, and we also do a lot of work with Indigenous communities in cities, whether that's Toronto, Hamilton, Niagara Falls. Those things are like are right part of who we are. And so when we had an opportunity to stand with some folks in Toronto here, we had a gentleman come up to me and introduce himself and told me a bit of his story. His mother being in residential school and dealing with the alcoholism and the trauma that she went through, and what that was like for him to live through it. And so he had run away from home when he was 15 and took to the street and lived most of his life on the streets in Toronto. And when I seen him, the Toronto Police Services were clearing his tent and throwing every belonging that he had in the garbage. And so when he started telling me who he was, I was like, I said, well, what's your last name? He said, well, my mom's last name was Green. And I said, really? I said, like, that's my neighborhood. Like, your family lives in my neighborhood. I said, when was the last time you were back to the res? And he said he'd never been. Like, that level of division that was created when they took his mom away to residential school, like, it really is like the lasting legacy of what those schools have done to our people. And so regardless of whether you're, you know, in Wet'suwet'en territory or Six Nations or in the streets in Toronto, like, land back is everywhere, you know. And I don't care where you feel safe. If that's the spot for you that you wish to occupy, you know what, these are our lands. These are all our lands. And if that's where you feel comfortable, I'm gonna do everything I can to make sure that you can stay comfortable there for as long as you possibly can.
And I just wanted to just chime in there for a second, because, you know, we get the question all the time, like, what is land back? What does it actually mean? And there's so many different levels to land back. You know, there's the actual legal land back, But, you know, we were just at the other day at Gunasado, which is the one of the original sites from 2006 that the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations members, had reclaimed. And, you know, going there, you see the bush growing back. You see, I mean, it could look like weeds to some people, but you see this diverse agriculture of plants and butterflies. As we drove up, there was a deer. The community has planted, you know, a white cornfield. And as I was walking there, I was like, you know what, just a couple kilometers down the road, you have all of this development, you have all of this pavement, all of these sidewalks and roads and cookie cutter houses. And that's, you know, that's how our society is measuring progress. But when we go out on that land and we see that, you know, 15 years later, the land is taking itself back, is healing itself, you know, we're like, that's progress to us. That's what progress looks like. And we have to change our mindset in that way. But it is hard when there are snipers and guns pointed at you. I've never felt anything like that. I've never been in trouble with the law. I've never had a gun pointed at me. So it's something that I'll never forget. And it's hard to understand, you know, the mindset. Like, how can you not want to save this? How can you not see how important, how valuable, how enriched this land and water is? But, you know, they're doing a job, they're getting a paycheck, they're following orders, or, you know, following someone else's bottom line. So it's, but we go, we continue. We will not give up. Because it's for the next generation, you know, it's for our children, it's for your children, it's for their children.
Absolutely. And I think that there are many people in Guelph who would, who also take very seriously land and water, as we are mandated to grow to 208,000 people by 2051. And the question is, will we have enough water for that many people? This is a very serious question, and I think it's forcing people in this community to ask, will we? And if, what will we need to do to make sure if that's possible, and maybe it isn't even possible? Because yes, like you say, water is life. I'd like to ask a question about the Land Back Unity Jam concerts, and just if you could describe the relationships that have developed through these events.
Hey, you want to take that one first? I think because like that was like the Layla first came down to Land Back for one of the very first ones of those, and so I want to lean on her a little bit for this one.
Well, I was one of the artists who was luckily not arrested for performing at Land Back during our Unity Jam. Some of the artists, like Tom Wilson and you know, some of these other musicians, really had to face consequences. But for us, it started as, you know, just Derek Miller bringing out a guitar and singing for the land defenders. And, you know, there's medicine in that. There's medicine in gathering around and listening to music and songs and singing together. And then that eventually grew. And last year, we had, oh gosh, I've never seen so many non-Indigenous people on the reserve in my life. And I looked around the crowd and I saw, you know, kids of every nation, every color. I saw, you know, Black, white, gay, straight, old, young, all there, just celebrating, enjoying. And, you know, I was like, that's what this space is about. That's what this whole movement is about, is to bring us all together to reconnect with this land, to protect this land. It's not just about, you know, giving it to the Haudenosaunee. It's about creating a space of unity. And that's the Unity Jams are such a symbol of that. We've had great support from the OFL and many other organizations who've come out and donated food, donate their time, set up bouncy castles, you know, so it's just, and all of the artists just donate their time and it just to put on an afternoon event outside. So we're looking at actually working on our next Unity Jam, which is coming up at the end of the year, which is the first time that we're actually fundraising for something specific. We're working with the, Native Horizons?
Native Horizons, yeah.
Native Horizons, which is a treatment center on the reserve that burned down. So they have lost their building and their ability to help people that are struggling. So we're looking at doing a full fundraiser actually inside at the Sanderson Center. So it's going to be a pretty cool event, bringing all the artists into like a formal, not just out on Land Back Lane. I'm like, yeah, we have toilets that flush. This is going to be a good event. So just keep your eyes posted for that coming up. But yeah, it's such a great way to see people coming together and supporting each other. And that's what this is all about. This unity, this unified voice of understanding each other, accepting each other, and working towards, you know, this path of true reconciliation. Like, what does that actually look like? Well, go to a Unity Jam and I'll show you what it looks like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what, like, I thank you does not even begin to explain like the gratitude that I have for all of those artists that have continued. And like, despite being arrested, like Tom Wilson, Rob Lamont, Phil Davis, like all these guys that, you know, like have performed, and Layla and Logan, and like they just all come out and like have continued to amplify the voices of the people on the ground doing the work, like, and for like Layla and Logan, like have participated in some of that work now, and have faced what the kind of the consequence of making these stands. And so like for them to continue to do that work, like, it is absolutely amazing gift that they've given us to you know, those moments that they've shown up to play their music, and you know, and we usually accompany that with a big lacrosse game, and you know, like this, like all of that is medicine for us. And so when, you know, every day you don't know whether or not the cops are coming to shoot at you again, you know, you don't know when when you're gonna have to pull taser darts out of your brother's back, like, because those are very real realities for us. And so that bit of medicine that they bring for us when they do these Unity Jams, like, it is an absolutely amazing gift. And and that bit of healing that you know, we all need to do in order to get through that stuff, like that music for me, especially for me anyways, is a big part of that. And you know, and so, and for Layla and her brother Logan that have been just amazing talent that have come out to do that. Derek Miller, that he got arrested at the airport flying to a gig, and he got arrested at the airport. And you know, like, this is like Phil Davis, he got, you know, surrounded at his home. Tom Wilson, you know, these guys have, you know, played in front of huge audiences and have come down to play for, you know, a few hundred of us at Land Back Lane, and got arrested for it. And like, and you know what, as soon as their charges were cleared, they were back doing the same thing again the next week. Like, I just, it is a real beautiful thing to be able to see these artists use whatever, whether they're, you know, musicians or poets or entertainers or columnists and newspapers, like, have all come down to support and amplify the voices of the people on the ground, that like it is quite the thing to see. And so I'm really, really grateful for that, and this opportunity now to work with the Native Horizons Treatment Center, you know, speaking of that healing. And what that music being medicine, like that's all part of it for me, and I think for all of our artists as well.
I'd like to thank you both for sharing all of this with us this morning.
Just as we're departing here, I just want to say again that Monday and Tuesday of next week we will be in court. There will be a rally out front for both days. And so if folks are interested and have the ability to get down, like, it is it is those moments where we're able to show the in numbers exactly what that means in terms of solidarity and what reconciliation looks like to the, you know, average Canadian that doesn't, you know, that you know, they support the Land Back movement. They support what reconciliation should look like. And so for folks that want to come out, please do. It is it should be an interesting time, both inside and outside the courtroom.
Absolutely. And thank you for letting us know that this is what reconciliation looks like.
Absolutely. And I'm really grateful that you've had me on the show today, and you know, look forward to being able to do that again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you both very much.
Of course. Nyama for having me. Bye-bye.
So I'm just going to quickly go through these announcements. There's a council planning meeting on September the 12th at 6:30. Look, there's three developments and the new high school. So check out the staff report. If you feel like delegating, please register to do so by 10 a.m. tomorrow. There's a council meeting on Wednesday, September the 14th at 6:30 p.m. We're going to hear about the update to the single-use plastics ban, the transition from the Blue Box recycling program to full producer responsibility. And Councillor Gordon is putting forth a motion regarding the idea of strong mayors. There are so many advisory committee vacancies. I struggle to put them all on the same page. So please go to Guelph.ca to find descriptions about them and how many vacancies are available. Please do apply by September the 22nd. The Guelph Pipe Band is celebrating its 100-year anniversary. And at McRae House Memorial Gardens, there is a free concert on Wednesday, September the 14th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. It's weather permitting, and please bring a lawn chair. The Guelph Jazz Festival is happening from September 15th to the 18th at 1 Carden Street. On Friday, September the 23rd at 8 p.m., Baja Bulat will be performing at the Royal City Mission. If you wish, and maybe you should, get to know your candidates, please check out Adam Donaldson's website. It's called Guelph Politico. All of the candidates, or most of them, have answered questionnaires. So please Google Guelph Politico to get to those questionnaires. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we'll get a Queen's Park update from Guelph's MPP, Mike Schreiner. On September 22nd, there will not be a show. On September 29th, it will be an open mic. On October 6th, Stephen O'Brien, who is the Chief Electoral Officer, will tell us about all things regarding municipal elections. On October 13th, Guelph's MP Lloyd Longfield will be here to update us on federal issues. October 20th, there will be no show. October 27th, we will have a post-election post-mortem. And with that, thank you all for joining the show today, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us today. Music is provided by Jules Germ. I'm Jiayu, and I produce this podcast. Breezy Breakfast, where the coffee is always warm, the conversation is hot, and the guests are as cool as cucumbers.